When Alexander Solzhenitsyn addressed the graduating class of Harvard University on June 8th of this year, he unleashed a most uncomfortable assessment of the Western world, and for those of us in this country, I think, feeling an uncomfortable assessment of the United States. And the press and the public have been fretfully trying to wrestle with the words of this most famous of the Soviet exiles in recent years for the past 7 weeks since he spoke. This most celebrated writer of our time is, of course, good friends with discomfort, suffering, and controversy. But it seems to me that his commencement speech was not calculated to expand his notoriety in the Western world, nor, I think, prompted simply to get our attention, as one commentator reminded us of George Bernard Shaw's words, in order to arouse Americans' eager interest, their distinguished consideration, their undying devotion. All that is necessary is to hold them up to ridicule the rest of the universe. That was Bernard Shaw's assessment. I don't think that Alexander Solzhenitsyn's criticisms are motivated by these reasons. As he says himself in the introduction to his address, they are the words of a friend and not an adversary. And he also indicates in his opening remarks that truth, in his words, truth is seldom pleasant. It is almost invariably bitter. Well, Mr. Solzhenitsyn readily acknowledges that he could have turned his attention to other quarters of the world in his address. He did limit his remarks to the Western world, that is obviously Europe and North America, probably partly since he has spent the last 3 years at least living in this country. And so it's not surprising, too, that his most pointed remarks sound so uncomfortably as though they were written specifically with at least one critical eye on our own country. And therefore, it seems especially fitting to consider carefully his observations by surely one of the world's great geniuses, who through his novels has served as a pulse to our conscience and who is a shaper of the deepest yearnings of the human spirit through his writings. I should say, I suppose, that simply because this fellow is an artist should not disqualify him immediately from candidacy as a contemporary prophet. Though I think we're more used to voices like a Nelson Rockefeller or even a Jean Dixon or a Betty Friedan at a time when that role is considerably diminished from what it was in the past. But even in the past century, in the 19th century, we are reminded of people like Tolstoy or Carlyle or Dickens, Dostoevsky, and so on, who exactly served this role as a public sage, as a commentator and critic of society at large. In our time, I think we have to admit that we're much less interested when a person of letters or of the arts attempts to raise his voice above the evening news. And so I suppose it's not surprising, too, that the press reaction, at least the press reaction that I have read in the popular press, newspapers, and the weekly news magazines, has tended to be fretful, tongue-clucking at least, and angered impatience at best, or vice versa, I should say. A few of the dozen or so reviews that I read, even in my estimation, really seem to get to grasp at the heart of Mr. Solzhenitsyn's message. In fact, it seemed to confirm one of the comments that he made in his address, which was that the press tends to be hasty and superficial in its judgments, and some would argue that that was the case in reaction to his speech.
Good protection against whatever they say, too, isn't it?
Exactly. But then this evening, you are to defend Mr. Folding. We have two members of the faculty this evening to comment on this address. Morris Wee is going to present Mr. Solzhenitsyn's remarks in their most favorable light, and Erling Jorsted will counter with some reservations and queries. Morris, do you want to open the conversation this evening?
I suppose the implication of that introduction is that I'm going to color Solzhenitsyn's remarks, if I can. Probably the best that I could put them in would be to read the address, but we haven't time, and I'm going to try to limit what I say to just a few minutes and focus on the points that stood out for me. The gist of his address, and most of you have heard something about it, I think, is very much like the main point of Douglas Hall's book that we keep referring to, Light in Our Darkness, which is the theme book for Holden this summer. And put crudely, I think it's something like this. Our society is on the verge of collapse. What is everybody smiling about? It's the kind of thing that Hall says, addressed particularly at North America and at the church. Solzhenitsyn addresses his remarks to what he calls the West, but many of the details of his argument are similar to Hall's. He starts out by citing a lack of courage, particularly among those visible leaders of the Western countries. He says that the leaders can take a moral position, and a fairly strong one, when referring to very weak and insignificant countries, but when it comes time for them to deal with the other powers in the world, they start to get wishy-washy, and he sees that as a sign of decline. Much of his address comes as a kind of he comes on as a prophet of doom, though one always suspects when someone makes the effort to raise his voice in this way that he has some hope, and he does conclude with some, as does Hall, in the same way. He talks about the danger of the comfort and the level of comfort and well-being that we have reached in our society, which we have tended to evaluate our success in terms of comfort and income. But he points out that we keep resetting our goals of what is sufficient comfort and what is adequate income, so that we're never satisfied, and this leads to a tension that we never resolve. He points out that even in the field of biology, it seems clear that habitual safety and extreme well-being are not advantageous for any living organism. Don't learn to prepare yourself for the tough times. And at another point in his address, he says this is the great advantage that the peoples have, and he divides the world into East and West. Quite often he means the U.S. and Russia. The Russians, having lived under six decades of oppression, have become a stronger people, while North Americans, Westerners, living in the lap of luxury, have become gradually weaker. The first really important point I think he makes is about our legalistic society. He says, we define what is right by the letter of the law. And he says, whenever you start defining what is right by the letter of the law, you're no longer taking moral responsibility. You no longer hold yourself responsible for making decisions. And I think this is certainly true of our own society, that quite often, if a person can be found not guilty by a court of law, then whatever he or she has done is exonerated by that judgment. And there isn't any other judgment that a person need apply. He applies that same, well, let me read, I wanted to read one segment from here. If one is right from a legal point of view, nothing more is required. Nobody may mention that one could still not be entirely right and urge self-restraint, a willingness to renounce such legal rights, sacrifice and selfless risk. It would sound simply absurd. One almost never sees voluntary self-restraint. And he modifies this by saying, I've spent all my life under a communist regime, and I will tell you that a society without any objective legal scale is a terrible one indeed, but a society with no other scale but the legal one is not quite worthy of humans either. He accuses the press similarly of not taking responsibility, but following only the letter of the law as their guidelines, and giving us a lot of hastiness and superficiality and gossip and very little analysis that would be valuable to us. Second major point I'd like to emphasize is Solzhenitsyn's analysis of our military strength the importance of U.S. military strength. He said that the episode in Vietnam was a betrayal of Far Eastern nations by our country, and that we failed to understand the significance of keeping power in the world as over against Russia and the evil of socialism and communism. He says we made the mistake of aligning ourselves with an evil power, that is Russian communism, against Hitler, and there seems to be talk again of the possibility of aligning ourselves with an evil power, whether it would be Russia against China or China against Russia, in the future, and to do that is to have to take in some of the evil of that society by that alliance. So he warns against that. He doesn't exempt Russia from some of the weaknesses he sees in the West. He says both the West and the East have been weakened by materialism and by a lack of spirituality. But his analysis of this as a power struggle, as he sees it is, and a power struggle between good and evil, sounds like Milton's Paradise Lost to listen to him speak, is his analysis is that the free West cannot withstand the system of communism without spiritual values. That there are some advantages to the freedom that we have, but if both the West and the East are working without spiritual values, that very systematized structure that Russia has will win. And therefore, we need to reassert our spiritual values in order to have something to counter that with. And his final point I want to emphasize is an analysis of what has happened to spiritual values in our era in the West. And this is probably the biggest, most profound point that he makes. It's not a new point, it's been made by others, but it's an important one. He says, beginning from the Renaissance, humans have placed more and more emphasis on the material world as over against the spiritual world. That up until that time, the spiritual was seen as the center of our lives. And since the Renaissance, we've increasingly placed the important, our energies, and we've put at the center of our world human beings and the material world. He calls this despiritualized humanism. Humanism is not in itself evil, but when it's despiritualized, it puts humans at the center and not God at the center, and leads to what we have today, where we have a strong emphasis on individual freedom, but gradually have lost our emphasis on the responsibility of the individual to take that freedom and use it with some responsibility toward society and toward God. Let me just read his comment about that. It's not important. Okay. I'll just conclude by reading his final remarks. If the world has not come to its end, it has approached a major turn in history equal in importance to the turn from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. It will exact from us a spiritual upsurge. We shall have to rise to a new height of vision, to a new level of life, where our physical nature will not be cursed as in the Middle Ages, but even more importantly, where our spiritual being will not be trampled upon as in the modern era.
Thank you, Morris.
I'm not sure, you know, I'll go as long as the voice holds out, but I want to make this brief and just comment on two or three things. And the assumption I'm starting with is that what he is doing in the speech is comparing what he doesn't like to in America to what he finds to be the best of the old tradition in Russia. And has a certain fun fact, he talks about our country, and referring to Russia, and sees himself in that sense. And thus the basis for comparison is not an extensive, you know, a long range, up close look at America, but from what one critic said, and I think I would agree, what he sees, especially on television and reads in some of the press, and as a result, I think, and sometimes misses the point. Sometimes I think he's you know, right on, but sometimes I think he rather misses the point. On two or three things I'd like to just comment. Three, I think, on the press and on the legalism and on the war. With this, I think he misses the point, for instance, on the necessary adversary relationship between the press and the government. Because he's talking about the fact that we have too much information and that there's too much of a flow and that people know too many things and we know too many things and that we don't need to know. And I would just like to see, you know, where you would draw the line. I mean, where would you like to stop on that? I don't buy the National Enquirer, you know, at the checkout counter and so on, but I think if people want to buy trivia and read trivia, that's you know, a choice. They have the right. I don't care what Farrah Fawcett is using for her latest hairspray, you know, really. But if that's the biggest event of the year for some people, then fine with that sort of thing. And I understand. I think he misunderstands the fact that sometimes the press has to do what it does because that's the only way it can get information out of the government. The necessary adversary role that the government has to play. And where would we be today without Woodward and Bernstein? I think this is a very, very important point that shouldn't be overlooked with this. Granted, sometimes the press is superficial, but honestly, how many of us would sit down every morning and read through the New York Times daily? I mean, the important things. One day when I was in New York, I sat down at 8:30 and I read through every story that I wanted to, that I thought was important, and I finished at 11:15 that morning. New York Times has the idea that more is better rather than more is less. I know, because if you smother a story, you know, you've got it covered. But you know, there are limitations. I mean, there are extenuating circumstances beyond that sort of thing. And I'm not all that afraid, really, of this sort of thing. I'll give you a perfect example of what I'm trying to say here about the necessary adversary role of the press and sometimes the liberties the press have to take. We know for a fact now that the FBI was trying to discredit Martin Luther King by planting lies in the press about him. And unless there had been some tough-nosed journalists around aware of this sort of thing, and the results might have been disastrous. King knew this, but didn't want to play the role of the martyr, obviously, by saying I'm being persecuted with this. And therefore, I'm not that afraid, really, of journalism, because I simply give more intelligence, give more credit for intelligence to the American people than I think Solzhenitsyn does on that point. On the legalistic sort of thing, on the matter of all of us, excuse me with a voice, I don't know if anybody's got a magic cure. My grandmother always had blackberry brandy as a magic cure for everything. And if anybody, well, anyway, from the standpoint of the legalistic sort of thing, where everything, you know, goes to the courts rather than being settled by consensus, I think, on the other hand, what has happened, especially since the 60s and some of the liberation movements, is that the whole concept of due process of law has taken on much more meaning and has become much more real for us, since we are much more conscious of rights than had been the case before. Whereas before, people would have given up because the system or the establishment or whatever else you want to call it was simply so powerful it wasn't worth doing. There are some cases that do get up, and there are some cases where justice really is served, and there are some cases where, you know, where it isn't served. Sometimes I think I don't know if Will Hurstfeld last week talked about the Wilmington 10. Did anybody? Because that would be certainly a very interesting case with this, or other cases where men have been in jail for a long time and have simply because of pressure finally been able to get justice. But just very briefly, I'm not so sure that the system is one simply of demanding individual rights without concern for the general welfare. And it was Rosalind Carter who pointed out that Solzhenitsyn overlooked, for instance, the fact that there were millions of people involved in voluntary service, contributions to society, that they were there because they wanted to be there, and that they weren't there because they had to be, but the society wasn't simply a matter of purely hedonistic or materialistic emphasis, but there were many in different services who were willingly contributing to their to the welfare of others. And the other one was on the military one, and that's the one that scared me, because the implication I got from this was that over on this page was that we should have American troops over in Africa. Was, I don't know, Morris, if that's the implication you got from it, but and the others who read this. And I'm wondering, if I took a vote here, how many of us would want, American troops over there? Or I think the same thing is true about the war in Southeast Asia, that saying that we lack courage to finish up the war. The only way I think we could have won the war in Southeast Asia is to drop nuclear weapons. Given the geography of the situation, and the way in which the war was fought, there was no other way. We tried everything that was possible. You remember McNamara was his maps and his charts and his overlays and everything else, and the Cambodian incursion and all the rest of these things. None of the traditional things were worked, and hence, if our withdrawal from Indochina was a sign of weakness, I would wonder what he would mean by a sign of strength. We could bomb them back to the Stone Age. That would be my particular feeling with this, because here's this one statement: but if a full-fledged America suffered a real defeat from a small communist half-country, how can the West hope to stand firm in the future? Well, that's not a fair argument. That's not a fair alternative. That's a fallacy of the undivided middle, if you like terms and logic, because the United States didn't, it wasn't a full-fledged America. That was participating in this on this. On the materialism thing, I can only agree with him 100%. I've got many more things written down here, but I would simply say that in these three cases, he has reasoned from what he thought the great strength of the old Russia was. I'll give you one example which kind of surprised me. Especially in light of the Ginsburg and the Skransky trials. Through intense suffering, our country has now achieved a spiritual development of such intensity that the Western system and its present system of spiritual exhaustion does not look attractive. That doesn't square with the way I understand the reading of the dissident trials at all. And this was done before the dissident trials. I'll grant you this was in early June, and the dissident trials was just last week. But and then another one here, talking about Russia, life's complexity and moral weight have produced stronger, deeper, and more interesting characters. and those generated by standardized Western well-being, if that's the case, then why are so many people trying to, you know, leave Russia? That would be my rhetorical question.
Is that your comment too about the trials? Or what's your, could you elaborate?
No, the point here is that if the country has achieved such a remarkable spiritual development of such intensity that it's better compared to the West, why then are there so many dissidents, and why are dissidents treated so shamefully?
But isn't that his very point, that because of the repression, that builds, in fact, spiritual character? That endurance of suffering.
But it's the dissidents who have the spiritual character, not the people, not the citizens. If the citizens were the ones who had the spiritual character, they would be the ones who would demand that there would be justice done for the dissidents.
No, here. But wouldn't.
Pardon?
Here.
That's what I'm trying to say. I mean, they didn't dare protest. A few people dared protest the trials in Moscow.
But there are different expressions of that kind, right? And not always simply in protest of a public trial.
But there might be different expressions of this, but this was so well publicized and such an outrageous, you know.
Are you aware that possibly the people in the Soviet Union were not even aware the trials were going on? That there is such a blackout there of information that they may not have been able to protest it because they wouldn't even know what was going on?
Well, how do I answer? I don't know. How does that square then with how can they be a well-informed, highly spiritually developed people if they don't know what's going on in the world?
Well, I think what Solzhenitsyn, from what I've read of his books, what he's talking about is the kind of trial by fire that the people have gone through with their families and immediate friends, immediate family, in camps.
Yes.
Not necessarily through public things like trials, but through personal, very intensely personal tribulations.
Okay. It's just when somehow the whole world is watching and a showcase comes up, it's a good chance to, you know, show the rest of the world, you know, what the country is made out of.
Except that I don't think that, I really sincerely doubt that the people in the Soviet Union were even aware, except a very small minority were even aware, even in Moscow, that the trials were going on.
Yeah, well, we're stuck at that point, so.
They're probably just grateful that there was a trial.
I don't understand.
Maybe they're just grateful that there was a trial, you know, rather than just to march them off.
Oh,
I don't know if there's any great source of information that says what the Soviet people are aware of and what they aren't, but I think from what little I've read that, I know one thing stands out in my mind is a section in the book The Russians by Hedrick Smith, where he talks about how Andrei Sakharov, I don't know how to say it, whatever, was on a beach with his wife, and all of a sudden over the radio came, over their transistor radio, came something that some kind of vilification about him or something like that. And all these people who never knew who he was all of a sudden said, oh boy, that's good that all the government's getting in trouble, they got out of the way. He was on the beach, started talking with them, asked if they knew anything about the guy or anything like that.
I don't want to give the impression that America is good because Russia is bad. That's not what Solzhenitsyn is saying.
No, he doesn't. It doesn't seem to me he devotes very much time or energy to establishing any superiority of the Russians, except in that case of what oppression will do to the individual character. He says that the governments or the systems are equally bad. They're both suffering from loss of spirituality. In the one case, it's enforced by the government, and in the other case, it's enforced by materialism, in our case. But he says they're both suffering from loss of spirituality. And I think that's the main...
It seems to me that it's really distracting for us to try to ask whether or not America is really better off than Russia.
Mm-hmm.
The better question, it seems to me, is to ask whether his criticisms of what's going on here reveal that our own needs and our own best aspirations are not happening. That we are not, in this country, doing the kinds of things that are needed, and that we are not living up to our own best aspirations. I find, for example, that when I talk to lawyers in Columbus, they are the ones who are most in despair over the legal system. Mm-hmm. And at least the thoughtful lawyers, not those who are just sort of grinding out a living, but the people who try to think about the spirit of the law are the ones who I think would probably stand up and applaud Solzhenitsyn, quite apart from whether or not law is happening in a good way in Russia. Or businessmen that I have talked to who are asking themselves, why should we spend all of our lives manufacturing, promoting, and selling really useless products? Umpteen brands of toothpaste, or umpteen varieties of soap, or the kinds of trivial things that really constitute so much of the American business system. It isn't really worth a person's life. That's not something that artists or prophets or theologians are saying. That's some of the kind of thing that I hear businessmen say. And I think the question really to be asked about the press is not a question about the quality of the New York Times. It's the quality of what happens in Wenatchee, Spokane, Seattle. Columbus, Ohio has two of the world's absolutely worst newspapers. and yet you have to read them if you want to be aware of what's going on locally. You just have to read them. You're forced to read them. And what comes across is so trivial, so incidental to the fundamental issues of human life, human well-being, the aspirations of human existence, that I listen to Solzhenitsyn again and I say, absolutely right, fundamentally right.
Where I stand too is fundamentally he's right. Like Erling, I was really scared when I read about what he proposed that we should have done in Vietnam and that we should do in the future. That's real scary to me, to think that maybe we should have been stronger. And I don't think he has maybe a clear conception of what this country went through in the 60s over that war. And maybe this is an instance of where he can't, because he hasn't been here that long and doesn't have a clear perspective on it.
Maybe to see stopping of the war as an expression of the fact that we didn't see materialism as justifying that kind of violence anymore. Seeing that as a lack of courage to stand up for values, and actually what it was people reacting against violence motivated by materialism.
Seemed to make two conclusions in the article that I would like to check out here. One was that in terms of the Russians, that somehow suffering produces spiritual strength. Sometimes it would seem to me that may produce despair and drug abuse, whatever. I'm not sure that always follows that suffering produces spiritual strength. The second assumption that I question is whether or not materialism automatically means a non-spirituality. I'm not so sure that follows. And that was kind of what I heard him saying. I'd just like to hear some response to that.
I would agree with that vice versa, too. Non-materialism does not necessarily do the reverse. You know? People can be just as trivial without materialism.
It's like you said about the Enquirer. I mean, the National Enquirer, if people don't read it, they will still talk to each other about it. It's, the press does not necessarily do that or make it happen.
Yeah, we welcome all of you to join the discussion, Carol.
I was going to comment on first what Walt said and then what Chuck was saying. That in this article, in his address, Solzhenitsyn is using the word press to include all the media, and I think that's even scarier, that considering all the people who don't read the paper, which is probably a little bit more coverage, but what they watch on the television, that quality of coverage is even maybe more subject to criticism, and he's including all the media when he talks about the press, and it's bound to be superficial and sometimes not trivial and very selective.
Well, one answer. You're disagreeing with his assessment.
No, I think it's bound to be that the public gets a very superficial and and sometimes very trivial.
Okay.
Let
me try this, and one answer would be to have, like the BBC, the third program, and have lots and lots of public information programs which do not sell and which are therefore financed by the government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that leaves open some questions and some possibilities. I saw Thai television and it was nothing more than glorification of the government. You know, I mean, that's one alternative. I'll grant you three, you
well,
know, I, there's
have
enormous...
Television that does more extensive news coverage and the issues, the coverage of issues. But how many people... I only get
Washington Week in Perspective. It's the only news show I get on our PBS.
But is his point really to prompt, you know, these kinds of responses, or is he simply suggesting that the press... television, newspapers, is symptomatic of a superficiality, of a hastiness, and of a kind of thin quality of spiritual life that's evident throughout the culture. That these are simply his, this is one of his items on his bill of particulars, some of which
okay.
we might agree with, some of which we may disagree with. Don't you think that perhaps his particular thin-skinned reaction to the press might be prompted, in fact, by the nosy newsman around his Vermont estate. You know, and then that out of that comes some of this, right?
Okay.
Go ahead.
I would like to agree with, you know, what you're saying now, and partly to respond to Dobie's first question about suffering.
Right. Thanks.
What I think what he's trying to say is that a spiritual intensity is not caused by suffering necessarily, but that spiritual maturity and intensity is not possible without it, and that our society is so bent on comfort and relieving suffering in whatever kind of form, that's another instance of the thinness of our culture and our depth of human personal experience.
I think from the readings that I've done, and maybe very superficially, of what Solzhenitsyn has written in his fiction and nonfiction, is that I don't think he would agree that outright suffering creates spirituality. In his books, he does point out that a lot of people do despair and do collapse and do anything to save their neck and do not rise above it. And he would agree that the failure rate of that kind of intense suffering is really high, that very, very few people come through a pure person without ever having fallen below into animal morality, I guess, or just into basic survival. I guess what I'm saying is, no, I don't think he would say, and I don't, if he would, I wouldn't agree with him, that intense suffering always produces spirituality. It doesn't.
I don't think he really says that.
Yeah.
The counterpart of that may be the more interesting question for us, and that is, does extreme comfort and our lack of danger or struggle over a long period weaken people?
But does that exclude suffering?
I think extremes of either.
Comfort excludes suffering.
Mm-hmm. I think what extremes of either would weaken. Extreme materialism would weaken.
It seems to me that a better word, I think we'd be missing the point, or we'd be hung up on the wrong point if we started arguing about suffering. Then we'd have to wonder whether masochists are not really the most spiritually developed people in the world. It seems to me that maybe a better word would be discipline. The ability to work towards meaningful ends and to
make the kinds of sacrifices that are necessary for that. He talks in his speech about our inability to have really meaningful goals. I think that's one of the points that he makes. And about our real inability to engage in some kind of discipline. I thought that was the kind of suffering that he was willing to talk about. He talked about self-limitation rather than self-indulgence. And I think a lot of the things that he's pointing to really are symptoms. We get the kind of television that we deserve. Johnny Carson can command $2.5 million a year. He isn't worth 5 cents, but he gets $2.5 million. What does that say to us? And sure, it's true that we can't afford certain kinds of things in television and newspaper, but we can afford many other kinds. It's the quality of what we're willing to pay for, and also, you know, what we're not willing to pay for, that exposes our own ability to have meaningful goals and to work toward them in a disciplined way. Well, we're going to get into some of the same things in education on Thursday evening, I'm sure. But that kind of discipline, it seems to me, would be a better subject for us to talk about than whether or not we ought to go out and see how much suffering we can accumulate in the next 24 hours.
I think your comments about the legal system, to me, it just pointed out the struggle that we have as Christians, the law gospel struggle. Just that when you don't have responsibility, it comes with freedom. These laws, an employer doesn't have enough decency to provide a safe place for his employees to work. So what happens? This monster is created called OSHA, which I don't know much about, but I guess it's really a disaster. I mean, laws upon laws is what the Jews ended up with when Christ came into the world. They just had what? Books and books of trivial laws that had to be that's what we're stuck with, because we're not, I mean, that's the issue we face with Christians daily and Lutheran, I guess, because we're constantly having a conflict between law and gospel. And whether
yeah, and this contributes really to Walt's comment about the lack of restraint, and so only those technical legalities.
Just push the letter of the law absolutely as far as possible and forget about
it. One of his little examples, for those of you who haven't read, I'm sure it's difficult to keep all these things in hand, but he uses, for example, a food producer who poisons his food in order to preserve it longer and is not held legally accountable for that, for those of us who eat that poison. Just one very small example of the sort of thing he's been talking about. Yeah.
One commentary that I read after his speech drew an analogy between his point of view and what happened in Nazi Germany. Everything was done within the letter of the law. It was all legal, and my mind was racing in reading the article now, and hearing the discussion. In Minnesota, we had a great power line controversy, and everything is being done legally, except that there are great numbers of people that are really suffering from that power line controversy. We're talking just very briefly this afternoon about the Native Americans in Washington State, and things are being done legally, the letter of the law, but where is the where the real human concern is being met. And I think we can cite example after example of where things are done according to the letter of the law, but there's a lack of spirituality, if you will. I think this is, I guess, I if this is what Solzhenitsyn was saying, I think he's right on.
It seems to me there's you develop a kind of a syndrome as you institute laws too, but when there are no laws, everything is done by voluntary self-restraint. And when that shows itself to fail, then we institute laws to force businesses to provide good working conditions and so forth, at which point they feel if they're doing that is sufficient. And the more laws, the more they resent having to be limited and won't ever restrain themselves independently. And I think that's, you know, partly what happens to us, for instance,
what are we going to substitute, though, in the secular sphere for rule by law, such as we know today? And whose moral authority are we, who's going to be responsible for this, for doing it a different way and a better way?
It seems that individuals just have to make a choice to push things to the other direction, to go less than up to the letter of the law in certain cases, and to use other standards for judgment.
I would back up and start off with the problem in this country is we're hooked on equality, and that to start it off with is that in any social situation, there's no such thing as individual self-restraint. Even in Locke's natural state, power accrued. And since power is going to accrue, it's going to accrue to those who are the strongest, or the greatest military power, or whatever, or the priests, the way they used to manipulate the people through the use of religion and so on. And so the way you control this is try to distribute the power as equally as possible. And you make the enormously, exciting and yet dangerous statement that all people's judgments are equal. Well, that's a mind-blowing kind of judgment, and the one that, which I don't think Solzhenitsyn really understands about America, that we really tried through the law, for instance, or through the legal system, to have equality, and that we're trying to break down the idea of different standards, for different income levels, and you could give lots of examples of that. And so what happens is when you say that there's equality, people started looking for differences of enforcement of equality, and one way this is expressed is through the law. And the Native Americans find that there is inequality, and so therefore they demand more equality, and therefore that means that there has to be more legislation put on the books. For instance, the same thing is true with protecting the workers. They had to put all kinds of restrictions on employers, because they weren't using safety guard devices, that they weren't guaranteeing unemployment accident insurance and all the rest of these things, and therefore trying, the idea was to balance out the sense of equality between those who have and those who don't have. And when you have that kind of system, you're going to inevitably, I think, add more kinds of restrictions, because they're necessary, because otherwise power is simply going to it's going to dominate. And the only way you can restrict that is to have legal means of control over those who have the power. And it's usually the rich and the, who have the power, and therefore, well, what's happened is an attempt, sometimes successful, not so successful, to restrain the power of the rich.
Are you suggesting then that this intensely legalistic society is almost an inevitability in a democracy?
In an industrial society, yes, in an industrial society, right. Because people are not going to put voluntary restraints on themselves. I think if we call for that and say Solzhenitsyn is right, we're deceiving ourselves. It's not going to happen. You can point to original sin as an example, or as a, as an explanation for this, if you like. John D. Rockefeller, is a perfect example of this, who could teach Sunday school on Sunday and exploit, the people enormously the other 6 days of the week. The American government, they used to say that on Sunday they would pray for the Indians, P-R-A-Y, and the rest of the week they would pray on the Indians, P-R-E-Y, as a good example of what I'm trying to say.
Solzhenitsyn is not saying that we need less law. He's saying that there must be in this country a spirit that goes beyond it, and that's, I think, again, the point he's making could hardly be more valid.
Yeah, but I just don't see how it can happen. That's what I'm trying to say. Given the fact that we reward our work by materialistic means, we judge ourselves on the basis of our salaries, for instance, and therefore we divide ourselves into categories, and since we're equal, we don't consider ourselves as good as other people until, like Dietrich will say, says that we achieve you know, a certain sort of middling point, and then from that point on, then they, you know, the middle rises farther. I just don't see how it's, you know, it's ever going to be accomplished. Ideally, it's fine.
But isn't that true in our legal system over the past years, though? There has been a somewhat a sign of going beyond the letter of the law, and there has been a somewhat of a spirituality to it. I don't think that the government has won very many of its cases against some of in a more publicized oppressive cases against people who were the Chicago 8, and you can go right down the list where the government does not have a very good record in exercising the legalism of their system. And I'm just wondering, I don't know if Solon Easton really...
Well, he doesn't deny that there are examples in our society, in any society, of that kind of moral strength and integrity and spiritual power. But what he's trying to do is to assess, you know, our society, the Western world, as he says, you know, from its broadest perspective. And there he finds it desperately lacking.
It's a very provocative answer.
I just want to say something real quick here. I'm not very old, so I don't know as much as probably a lot of people in here, and definitely not as much as Solon Easton does. But I've lived here in Vancouver, Washington, in the United States of America for 19 years, and that's longer than Solon Easton's been here. Now, that doesn't mean that I know more than he does, though, right? But because he's older than I am, doesn't mean he knows more than me about the United States either. His view of the United States is very limited because he's been here not very long. And of course, I think that you have to live over a long period of time and all over the United States to know what he's saying. He's saying that the Western world is this and this and this, but it's been very limited. You'd have to live here for hundreds and hundreds of years and to live all over to know completely, like the way he sounds, to know like he knows completely, you know?
Yeah. This might sound contrary to what I'm saying, but the best commentary that's ever been made by America was somebody who was here for only 18 months, and that was Alexis de Tocqueville in 1831, and it's still as sound as, you know, as could be. He's a student, I think Solon Easton is a student of the human spirit. And he sees universal. He's talking about universals at work.
And it really brings us back to Walt's comment earlier, and that is his comments, as he says, are made as a friend, not as an adversary. He's raising these questions. It's a matter for us then to assess their truth or falsehood, and from our own deepest awarenesses. And the question is then, what is most evident to us? If that, if you truly feel that the spiritual stock of America is bullish, then there's probably not much one could do to convince you in a short while that that isn't the case. But I think what you were suggesting, Walt, I, not to turn it back to you, I don't intend that, but in your taking of the pulse of your community, it seems in fact to be quite in harmony with what Solzhenitsyn is suggesting on the basis of only his 3 years' experience here. Huh?
In the spring, the small group of Nazis wanted to march in Skokie. Legally, they were allowed to do it. But it seems to me it's an outrage for a handful of Nazis who represent what they do and live with the heritage that they claim to march through a suburb of Chicago that has survivors of the Holocaust. Legally they can do it, but it's a human outrage. And how do you stop it? What do you do?
I'd like to say something about that. Martin Marty came to speak at our college this spring, and he referred to that specific incident. he said there was a huge backlash to it for those very reasons, because it is a human outrage. And he was among those who found himself in the position of defending those neo-Nazis' right to march through Skokie or wherever. And he said, it was a dangerous kind of situation, because all of your human impulses are to say, we can't allow this to happen. It's an outrage. These people have to be forbidden to do this. But when you do that, you pose the question, what expressions are we going to allow and what expressions are we not going to allow? Who is going to decide who can make a demonstration, who can make a statement, and who won't be allowed? He said it's the kind of situation where to preserve freedom of speech, you make a stand on behalf of these people, and then you go in the bathroom and retch. And that was exactly what he said.
When Pannenberg came to Columbus, Walter Pannenberg, one of the points that he made in his lecture was that our freedom, our opportunities have not really revealed our freedom. They have instead revealed our bondage. And I think we have to look at, I would agree with Marty that we have to defend the rights of the most reprehensible minorities. But what our opportunities have revealed in this country is the trivialization of our lives. Jen and I on Friday night looked for a good movie to go to in Spokane. They were either inane or X-rated, and neither one seemed to be particularly appealing. We ended up not going. When you give unlimited opportunity, which we really have had to do, what is revealed is our poverty of expression. We have three television networks in this country to compete with each other. They have not again revealed the strength of our interests, but the weakness, the poverty of our interests. Laverne and Shirley, you know, is as high as we are. I mean, I think that's really tragic. Driving from here to Spokane, we saw the highways littered with refuse cans. You drive through American cities, they are some of the most unesthetic experiences you can imagine. Nicely manicured lawns. I will take care of my own 75 by 150 feet, but I will dump anywhere else, especially on public ground. So our freedom, you see, has revealed only the meanness of soul, the poverty of spirit, the weakness, the bondage. I think that's what Solzhenitsyn is pointing to. And if we don't hear that, then we are blind and deaf and I think deserve the judgment to come.
Just like he says, just so if the law is not the outer limits, you know, like it's not set up something we don't go beyond, but it's something everybody wants to do. You know, they want to reach like tax evasion. You know, it's not something you look and you say, that's as far as I can go, but as long as it's there, you got to do it. Like abortion. You know, it's legal, so it's right, according to some people. You know, that we don't set up outer limits and not try to exceed them, but everybody has, once that law is set up, then everybody's supposed to try to just barely squeak by and getting by. Mm-hmm. I think that's what his point to me was saying.
I really wonder if he has seen our outer limits, though. And Wall, what you say sounds good to me. That we're, in a way, that in our system we are willing to reveal our weakness. What's the alternative?
I guess I'm trying to say we must look at what is being revealed here, and what is being revealed does not give me all that much encouragement.
But is he saying anything very new to us that we don't already know about ourselves and so obvious as what we're in?
Well,
No, I think we're impressed because here was a man who was undergone enormous suffering, and a man who has, he talks like a 19th century novelist with power and conviction, and who commands our respect. And I would, you know, I got stuck with being the adversary. I'm sorry, I didn't say it. I'll defend two out of my 3 points, but on what you're saying, Walt, I agree with you, and I don't, you know, I'm trapped because in this country, we're as I say, I don't want to come back to it necessarily, but we're trapped on this equality thing, and that the level of culture always settles on the lowest common denominator. You come out on the train as I did, and got down to dirty jokes and sports in the regular conversation, as because that was one thing, or the weather or something, where that's something we can all agree on, and it's so ingrained in this country that I can't see any real way in which it can be reversed without it violating what almost everybody accepts this country is all about.
It's helpful to say again that he's not providing prescriptions either. And this is a kind of prophetic indictment, it seems to me, and he's not a candidate for dictatorship. No artist is. It's his job simply to reveal job. It's his inspiration to do so, to reveal.
I think it's really up to us to decide, and maybe we don't go any place with it, but even if it's been said 100 times, I don't think just because it's been said 100 times it doesn't need to be said again. And even if it doesn't look like we can't find a way out, that's reason for not looking further.
He seems to suggest, in fact, the reason, at least one of the reasons why it does need to be said again and again, and that is that we don't really believe it.
No, I think
he refers, one of his key points is that basically Western society is optimistic about man, that evil is a curable disease, that if only we tinker with the fine tuning of our parliaments and schools, that somehow we'll have ourselves cured.
And the pressure reaction bears that off.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree.
It is
missed
his point completely.
Carol, you've been waiting a long time.
Maybe some people who are better theologians than I, but it seems to me that there's a reversal of law and gospel here. In that the kingdom on the left is the one that's saying you're free to do anything you want, and the church and the so-called people who should be proclaiming freedom are proclaiming the law instead. That is, the whole rest of the country has gone crazy with its freedom, instead of the secular world being the ones that have to have the law to keep them in line. They're the ones that are saying, we're free to do anything we damn well please, and then the church comes along, or the quote spiritual elements or something, and says, and they're the ones that end up preaching the law. And this, it's a reversal. The gospel never gets proclaimed. Am I way off, Walter?
It has something to do with the way he uses the word freedom, I think, that's critical. Right?
Well, I don't know the terminology.
You might choose a different term for his statement that we have unlimited freedom, to pursue our enjoyments.
Well,
you
not,
might call it license.
I'm not so society here. I think that he's assessing our society as the part that should be have strength and courage, as you might say. That's that secular government and those kinds of control have fallen apart, and everybody's saying, I'll do whatever I can get away with. And then I think that somehow or other the church and the elements of society which have normally proclaimed the gospel are in the end up by saying, we've got to stop this, and they end up proclaiming the law.
Could we have maybe one final comment here, and then we'll take a recess for a couple of minutes, and then...
Can I say something on a positive note, then? Okay.
And then you still get your final
comment. Okay, I must identify myself. I'm a junior high school music teacher, and I work with junior high age level kids. And I've seen in the last 5 years some of the most remarkable things happen with kids in that age level. I see a turnaround that's taking place. It isn't so much an I and a me and things for myself, but I'm seeing kids having concerns for other people and wanting to go out and do something other than just getting a job, earning a living, having money for themselves, and going out and buying whatever they want. But this is the encouraging thing, and I think this is where our future is. Now, these young, in this particular age level, and I see it in a lot of others too, where they're wanting to do things for other people and not necessarily for themselves. And I think that's where our future is, and that's why I have a great deal of confidence in what's going to happen in this country in the next years. We're going to solve problems. We've got lots of them. But I think it isn't going to be you and I that's going to solve them, because, I just think it's going to be these younger people that are going to do it. And they're going to do it in a way and in a fashion and a manner that's going to surprise us. In my old age and my gray hair, when maybe I'm 65 or 70 years old, it's going to be a different country that we're going to live in. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be because of what some of these young people are doing. They're really going to do the job. Because I see them doing it now. I see them thinking and planning.
Thank you for your comment. One final one.
I don't think that I am criticizing either this country or what it talks about this country. The world is expecting the United States of not only economic but also ideological things. And he mentions that the world experts are looking forward to the United States to offer. And when I read the article, the talk, I was thinking what the United States has to offer. And what is the American ideology to this world, to be offered to this world. And so far, the United States has been giving to this world different things. But I was thinking, what is the American ideology to substitute for communism? And if some of you may say that we have democracy, human rights, things like that, I would agree with that. But my next question would be, what is the spirit behind those ideas? Solzhenitsyn mentions Russia. Russia has systematically something, at least state, as their power source. He doesn't justify that. He mentions, but what the United States has as a power, as a spirit, to give to this world. I just wanted to listen to your discussion, mm-hmm. And this question is not an answer.
Gee, I was just ready to answer it. Thank you very much. Yeah.